Live from New York City, it's the Gary Null Show. And now, your host, Gary Null.
Hi, everyone. I'm Gary Null, broadcasting and video streaming live from our studios in New York City, and I welcome you. You can watch our program by going to ustream.com, I believe it is, and look for Gary Null. Today, this is our talkback segment. No guest, no in-depth commentaries, though I will be sharing some commentaries on the environment and one on the plight of the American farmer from Ralph Nader. Also, I know that many of you are concerned about what's going to be happening to our currency, the value of our dollar, our savings. And to understand that, I'll be doing an entire three-hour special with 12 of the world's leading economists. And they all are pointing in the same direction, trouble. So I'm going to give you a little preview of the number one organization in our world that causes more trouble for we, the people, but is a best friend of big business, the Federal Reserve. From Michael Snyder, the 10 things that every American should know about the Federal Reserve. Of course, throughout the entire program, I'll be inviting you to call in and share your thoughts, your questions, your concerns. Our number is 888-874-4888. 888-874-4888. You can also listen over the telephone. You can download programs. You can view our archives by calling 619-550-0869. 619-550-0869. There are some nutrients that most people are unaware of how significant the impact can be on our biochemistry. One of those nutrients is called taurine, T-A-U-R-I-N-E. It is very important. It is one of the most essential nutrients for our body. You're not going to get a lot from your food. And the older we get, the more difficult it becomes for our body to synthesize it from cysteine. It goes down. Now, why should you be concerned about taurine and supplementing? Maybe 1,000 milligrams a day. That would be a good amount. For several reasons. First, because if you're pre-diabetic or diabetic, it helps with glucose stabilization. It helps regulate your blood sugar level, and that's important. It also is very good to help people who may suffer from a deficiency of calcium to better absorb the calcium into their bones. That's excellent, because when you have good calcium in your body, your heart beats more regularly, your muscles are stronger and able to contract, you run faster, and of course you have a stronger muscular system. Also, it's great for your eye care. Now, we know about lutein and other nutrients, lycopene, but taurine is also very good for your eyes to help prevent macular degeneration and cataracts. It regulates your central nervous system, and people who've been drinking a lot of coffee have dysregulation, and that's why they're hyper and jittery, and when you take them off caffeine, they generally go through excruciating migraine headaches, insomnia, and irritability. Also, it's great for maintaining a cellular balance between the water in and outside of cells. And that's very important. Otherwise, you end up with edema. It helps modulate your immune system. It helps with cognitive function, liver function, and it's great for your heart. Just one nutrient, but one that we don't get enough of in our diet. New research on the omega-3 fatty acids. There must be 3,000 or 4,000 studies now showing you why this is so important. But when they come out, I want to make sure that you have the latest science. This is from the University of Pittsburgh, and it comes from the American Heart Association, and it shows that the omega-3 fatty acids are good for your oral and skin cancer prevention. Quote, from Queen Mary University of London, both, there are two different colleges, Queen Mary and University of London, they found that malignant oral and skin cancers were able to be stopped with omega-3 fatty acids. So one more reason, and especially if you know someone who's been smoking or drinking, because drinking creates an extremely acidic state in your mouth and throat. You can literally, with alcohol, you burn the sensitive mucous membranes, and you also burn the tongue. Have you ever noticed when someone takes a drink of hard alcohol, they always make a face? Because that's how strong it is. Why anyone would drink that, except for what it does in altering their perception of reality, is beyond me, because it just tastes terrible. But it's very caustic. Hence, throat cancers and oral cancer. Now, for those of you who say, all right, I don't eat fish, what other sources are there that are good in the omega-3 fatty acids? There are several: ground flax seeds, walnuts, soybeans, and tofu are all good sources. So whether you're going to get your omega-3 from vegan or fish sources, make sure you get about 2,000 milligrams a day. A new study from UCLA shows that happiness can affect your genes. Now, this is just an ongoing flowing of research from quality sources that are now confirming what you have been listening to for a long time. Since clearly the mid-70s, when I began to do the research in the laboratory that showed this, and that is that happiness definitely affects your genes. Here's what they say, quote, "If you're happy and you know it, positive psychology impacts gene expression in humans. Dr. Stephen Cole from UCLA led a team who examined the human genome, some 21,000 genes, in light of two different classifications for happiness. The hedonic well-being, the type of happiness associated with some self-gratification, and then the happiness that comes from a deep sense of purpose and meaning in life." Now, here's what they found. That when you're doing something that's meaningful, something that you feel is part of your living legacy, you're just being a good person. You're kind, you give your time, energy to other people, you share, you're positive, you're a loving human being. That type of happiness actually turns on the gene expression in a very positive way. I was looking today back through my old archives, and I found my original lecture notes from 25 years ago on happiness. And in there, I said that love, the energy flows out. Fear, the energy's blocked in. Anger, it's blocked in, even though you express it. You may even express it with rage. Still in. Insecurity, uncertainty, anxiety, you lock the energy in. When you feel creative and free to express yourself, you're letting your energy flow. Now we actually can prove that at the genetic level, which is one more reason that it's not just you specifically, it's the condition you've had, the people in your life up to this moment, and how you responded to the people. Have you adapted to them? What if you adapt to their anger, their biases, their prejudices? Then it impacts your DNA. I did a lecture this morning, and I talked about, is it possible to be healthy in an unhealthy environment? And I believe it is not. Not in the way that we have been led to believe. For the last 30 to 40 years, we've been told by thousands upon thousands of self-empowerment and self-help books, New Age gurus galore, that all we have to do is focus on what we want and focus on positive thoughts and block out the negative thoughts and everything's fine. It isn't. Because now we can show that the inability to transcend an environment means that you actually adapt to it. And I saw this reflected several years ago when I was filming for a de-stress documentary, my first, on that topic, and I selected a whole series of yoga studios and spiritual retreats, and as I filmed inside, where people were feeling very good, and there was a sense of serenity and just relaxation in the room, what they didn't know is I'd set a camera up outside. I wanted to see what was the energy like when they left that serene yoga studio. And suddenly it's the cell phones are on and people yelling into the phones and people lighting up cigarettes. To me, for many, not all people, they use the entire armamentarium of spiritual awareness as a little oasis, but they choose to suffer the remorse of adapting to the desert. So it's not what you do when you have that real little respite and you go in and do your yoga for an hour, or you do your bike around Center Park at 6 in the morning. It's what you do with the other 23 hours of a day. Are you the same person, or do you flip back into that defensive, negative, fearful, insecure, and hence gene-off mode? I think we have to have an entirely new discussion about how we have adapted to our relationships, to the people in our lives, to the environment that we work in, and because we gain something from all these, we try to justify what we don't like. We hide it, dismiss it, try not to have it interfere with us, but on an energetic level, it does. So think about the people who are simply happy. They create happy environments. They are truly living a happy life, irrespective of their circumstances. And this means that a poor person can still be happy. They may be poor, doesn't mean because you're poor, you have to feel poor. You have to emote poor. Just as there's no law of the universe that says because you're rich and gifted with all these possessions that you have to be happy. Having counseled thousands of very successful people, billionaires, hedge fund owners, I can tell you, they didn't buy happiness. They don't have that. So, and that's what I believe leads to a lot of disease at an emotional level. Next up, grapes are good for adults and children. There's a whole new article on the power of grapes from the Journal of Food Science, and they started finding that the more grapes you eat, especially in any non-alcoholic form, and fresh grapes, raisins, 100% grape juice, then you're going to be healthier. You're going to have better blood chemistry, and you're going to be able to live a longer life. Also add in a daily dose of ginger and cinnamon can relieve muscle soreness significantly. This is another study, and especially for people who have any muscle soreness. Just do this. Each day in your health drink, put about a quarter of a teaspoon of cinnamon. Also put in there about a quarter of an inch of ginger. Grate it and put it in. And that can help your body because they're both extremely anti-inflammatory and therefore very healthy for you. Also, some new research on how blueberries help you maintain a stronger immune system, especially if you are a person that has had a weakened immune system. And they're saying that it's the resveratrol in the blueberries and grapes that can impact your immune system in a very beneficial way. And it's not just blueberries, but it's all berries can do this. So that's all good. Also, a new study shows that for 30 million Americans suffering from dry eyes, the omega-3 fatty acids have just been proven in a new study to relieve that. This was done at the Baylor College of Medicine and the Virginia Eye Institute. They found that postmenopausal women with tear dysfunction in both eyes, they can't create tears. When they start using the omega-3 fatty acids, that's a substantially improved condition, and that can help you with dry eye syndrome. And they're now finding that, gee whiz, the yeast in some vaccines is tied to autoimmune disease. This is from Heidi Stevenson from Gaia Health, and she says the following. It is well recognized that the incidence of autoimmune disease has been rising at an enormous rate. A new study indicates that a significant factor in causing them may be the common baker's or brewer's yeast used in many vaccines, including hepatitis B, which is given to new or nearly all newborn babies in the United States the day they're born. The specific part of the yeast that's of concern is called mannan, M-A-N-N-A-N, which is found in the cell walls of yeast and also in the mammalian glycoproteins. These glycoproteins are found in cell walls, connective tissues like collagen, gastrointestinal mucus, secretions, and blood plasma. But they're ending up in the vaccines. When that happens, you end up with all kinds of problems, and they're showing that rheumatoid arthritis, lupus erythematosus, heart disease, sclerosis, associated antigens, all from the yeast in vaccines. Breastfeeding during pregnancy, and hopefully about 2 years, will mean better intelligence later in life. From Boston's Children's Hospital, quote, breastfeeding longer is associated with better receptive language at 3 years of age and verbal and nonverbal intelligence at age 7, according to the Journal of the American Medical Association's Pediatrics. So, one more reason to be breastfeeding your child. Protein is a big problem in the American diet for several reasons. First, because we eat way too much of it. Way, way too much. And we have these myths about it. And one of the myths is that only animal proteins will create strong bodies. You think? Wrong. Well, let me just think. A gorilla? That's about as strong as you get. Oh, a hippopotamus? Yeah, giraffe? Got that. Elephants? All long-lived and very strong. All vegan. We, on the other hand, our gastrointestinal system is long. It's meant to be alkaline, not acid. We don't have the teeth for ripping and tearing. In fact, virtually everything about our anatomy shows that we were designed to digest tuberous foods, nuts, seeds, grains, legumes, fruits and vegetables, to chew them. Even the enzymes that are secreted under the tongue. If you were to open your mouth, lift back your tongue, you'll see that there's a little soft tissue. There's two little holes, and about 2.5 quarts of saliva pour out of those holes each day. And the moment you're eating anything that is a carbohydrate, ptyalin and amylase, two of these starch-splitting enzymes come out and start to salivate. They mix in with your saliva. They mix in with your chewing. Hence, the longer you chew, the better the digestion. In fact, you're already creating a chemical, not just a mechanical digestion in the mouth, by this. And so, therefore, once you swallow this, what is called bolus, when it's properly masticated, it's already in the process of being broken down. Then when you get in the stomach, it further breaks down and then goes in the intestine, and it should ideally go in the intestine about the consistency of a soup, a thick soup. Now look at a lion, look at a cat, look at a dog, a wolf. They all have very short intestines, highly acidic stomachs, and teeth and jaws that are meant to be able to break open flesh, fur, skin, hides, bone. And they can eat it all. And they can gorge themselves. A lion can eat about, depending upon the size of the lion, upwards of 60 pounds of food, one sitting. And the body actually digests that. We can't do that. So then put that in the context of a wonderful, for the meat industry, propaganda campaign that led people to believe you have to have meat three times a day. So now that's seared into the American psyche, but it's wrong. It's completely wrong. Fact, all the science shows that those who are vegan live longer lives, generally at least 7 years. You can actually add on to that if you take your supplements and exercise. You're far more susceptible to heart disease, cancer, cancer of the colon, prostate cancer, the more meat you consume. But watch any of the television programs. They're not just giving supersized portions. They're giving gigantic portions. They're giving a week's worth of protein in one meal. Ideally, here's how you should eat your protein. Three times a day. You should have anywhere from 20 to 30 grams of protein in the morning, in the early afternoon, early evening. Because protein can't be stored. So if you took all your protein in the morning, you're going to be having problems later in the day because you need protein amino acids throughout the day. Here's the latest study. This is from the Atlanta Journal Constitution, and it's from the British Journal of Nutrition, and it's also from University of Arkansas Medical Sciences. Quote, foods packed with protein aren't just for young weightlifting bodybuilders anymore. Emerging research links eating high-quality protein foods with healthy muscles, no matter how much you compress to impress or how many birthdays have passed. Then it goes on to talk about why you need protein three times a day. And they're correct, and that's what I've been saying for a long time. So they finally caught up with me. But I'm saying we're eating too much protein. Try to look to get no more than 30 grams at a single serving. And this is interesting. This study is from the Advances in Nutrition, a peer-reviewed journal. And here's what it says. High intake of red meat linked with risk of type 2 diabetes. Quote, a review in the current issue of Advances in Nutrition found an association between a high intake of red meat and a higher risk of type 2 diabetes. Advanced glycation end products, or AGEs, and advanced lipooxidation end products, ALEs, were proposed as mechanisms with iron as the potential link. Iron facilitates the formation of these advanced glycation end products. In lay language, what this means is that the more red meat you eat, the greater risk you have of diabetes. And finally, before we go to your phone calls at 888-874-4888, watermelon juice soothes sore cycling muscles. Quote, watermelon juice has excellent potential as a functional drink to relieve sore muscles in athletes due to high levels of amino acid L-citrulline. That's a new study testing cyclists. And it goes in to talk about the science behind it. And the title of the article is Watermelon Juice Potential Functional Drink for Sore Muscles Relief in Athletes. Published in the Journal of Agricultural and Food Chemistry. Well, watermelon juice is what we use for 20 years in the New York City Marathon. We would spike it with some green and red powders, and without knowing the chemistry, we know the impact. If you were going through a marathon, if every mile you had a cup of watermelon juice, that you didn't have the same muscle fatigue. Now we know that specifically on athletes, it helps you. So if you're going out for a bike ride, if you're going out for a run, have yourself some watermelon juice before you go out. I'm Gary Noll. That's the latest on health and healing. Back in a moment with your calls. 888-874-4888. 888-874-4888.
Yeah.
like to welcome all of you. I'm Gary Knoll. This is our Talk Back program, and we had some problems with our lines a moment ago. If you tried, you weren't able to get on. Now you can. So please give us a call at 888-874-4888. 888-874-4888. I saw them all lit, and then I saw that it blanked out. So our engineer just rebooted it. You can call back in. While you're calling in, I'll give you some of the latest from Ralph Nader. This is from our environmental segment. This is an article he's written called "The Plight of the Farmer Continues" from Counterpunch. The great reporter Edward R. Murrow titled his 1960 CBS documentary "Harvest of Shame" on the merciless exploitation of the migrant farm workers by the large growers and their local government allies. Over 50 years later, it is still the harvest of shame for nearly 2 million migrant farm workers who follow the seasons and the crops to harvest our fruits and vegetables. As a student, I went through migrant work farm camps and fields and wrote about the abysmally low pay, toxic, unsafe working conditions, contaminated water, housing hovels, and the complete absence of any legal rights. It is a perversely inverted society when the people who do the backbreaking work to harvest one of the necessities of life are underpaid, underinsured, underprotected, and underrespected, while the Chicago commodity brokers, where the white-collar gamblers sit in air-conditioned spaces and speculate on the futures and foodstuff prices, are quite well off, to put it modestly. It probably won't surprise you that the grapes, peaches, watermelons, strawberries, and apricots and lettuce that you're eating this week are brought to you from the fields by the descendants of the early migrant workers. Their plight is not that much better, except for the very few working under a real union contract. Start with the exclusion of farm workers from the Fair Labor Standards Act, then go to the EPA's Worker Protection Standards, which is aimed at protecting farm workers and their families from pesticides but is outdated, weak, and poorly enforced. Continue on to the unyielding local power of growers and their campaign cash indentured local, state, and congressional lawmakers. The recent shocking description of the tomato workers in Central Florida in Chris Hedges and Joe Sacco's book Days of Destruction, Days of Revolt show how close defenseless migrant workers had come to involuntary servitude. In a recent television interview featuring Velasquez, a vigorous farm worker organizer, Bill Moyer summarized the period since Harvest of Shame. Quote, "Believe it or not, more than 50 years later, the life of a migrant laborer is still an ordeal. And not just for adults, perhaps as many as half of a million children, some as young as 7 years old, are out in the fields and orchards working 9 to 10 hours a day under brutal conditions." Among the conditions Moyer was referring to are the daily exposures to pesticides, fertilizers, and the resulting chemically related injuries and sicknesses. Far more of these pesticides end up in the workers' bodies than are found in our food. President of Farm Worker Justice Bruce Goldstein writes, quote, "Short-term effects include stinging eyes, rashes, blisters, blindness, nausea, dizziness, headaches, coma, and even death. Pesticides also cause infertility, neurological disorders, and cancer." In a recent letter appeal by the United Farm Workers, the beleaguered small union representing farm workers, these ailments were connected to real workers by name. Focusing on the large grape grower of the Geomera Vineyards of California, the United Farm Workers describes one tragedy of many. Quote, "After 10 hours laboring under a blazing sun, 53-year-old Guiomara grape picker Valdivia became weak, dizzy, and nauseated. He couldn't talk. He lay down in the field. The temperature was 102 degrees. His 21-year-old son, Luis, and another worker rushed to his side, called 911, but a foreman canceled the paramedics. He told the son to drive his father home. They reached the emergency room in Bakersfield too late. He had died in the car seat next to his son," end quote. For backbreaking work, kneeling 48 hours a week on crippling joints, 29-year-old Algerardo Ruiz and other farm workers are not making much to live on. The federal minimum wage is $7.25 an hour, but it does not apply to farm workers. Workers without documents are often paid less than those with documents. In most cases, they are too frightened to consider objecting. It is so deplorable how little the members of Congress from these farm districts have done to improve the plight of migrant farm workers. Members of Congress could be raising the visibility of deplorable working conditions faced by farm workers and aligning themselves with urban district representatives concerned about food safety. This partnership could raise awareness of the safety of the food supply, the careless use of agricultural chemicals, and the press and the EPA to issue a strong emphasis on training, on disclosure of chemical usage, on safety precautions prior to spraying and buffer zones. Is there a more compelling case for union organizing than the farm workers who sweat for agribusiness? Federal labor laws need to be amended to improve national standards for farm workers and eliminate existing state fair wage and health barriers. California has the strongest law, passed under the first gubernatorial term of Jerry Brown in 1975. Even this law needs to be strengthened to overcome the ways it has been gamed by agribusiness. Next time you eat your fruits and vegetables, pause a moment to imagine what the workers who harvested them had to endure and talk up their plight with your friends and coworkers. Remember, every reform starts with human conversations and awareness. End quote, Ralph Nader. Also from our environmental segment, it was 6 years ago that I said that we are going to approach a point where we will have a tipping, and no matter what we do, it will not stop the climate from changing so radically that it'll impair our lives. But most people thought it wouldn't happen soon, maybe in 100, 200, 300 years. No, it's happening now, today, as I speak. Here is the latest assessment from Science Daily. And this is from the Department of Global Ecology at Carnegie Institute and published in the peer-reviewed Science magazine. Quote, "The planet is undergoing one of the largest changes in climate since the dinosaurs went extinct. But what might be even more troubling for humans, plants, and animals is the speed of the change. Stanford University climate scientists warned that the likely rate of change over the next century will be at least 10 times quicker than any climate shift in the last 65 million years. If the trend continues at its current rapid pace, it will place significant stress on terrestrial ecosystems around the world, and many species will need to make behavioral, evolutionary, or geographic adaptations to survive." Well, there you have it. We're in for it. And they looked at 24 different climate models, and they all showed the same thing. Once it hits 2 to 4 degrees Celsius increase, it's game over. Okay. What does that mean for you and I? Well, since this broadcast goes all over the world, if you live within 50 miles of the ocean, you run the risk of having enormous surges, tidal surges, that can start to back into cities that are at sea level, such as New York City, Washington, D.C., Miami. That'll flood out your subway systems and people's basements initially. By the time they realize how bad this is, you're going to have it getting so hot that there won't be a gradual release of water from Iceland, Greenland, or Antarctica, the two major glaciers in Antarctica. You could have a major melting in just one season, one season, where amounts are going to break off, calve, go into the ocean that no one ever anticipated. Let me show you how this is happening as we speak. 5 years ago, if you were to see a photograph of a piece of ice on land, a glacier, breaking off what is called calving and falling into the ocean, it might be 200 feet across, maybe 60 feet high. 3 weeks ago, a calve broke that was larger than Manhattan, largest ever recorded. That's how big they are now. And that means that the pull, the gravitational pull of these glaciers into the water is being speeded up because the water at the top is melting, going to the bottom and acting like a skid, like someone sprayed DWF-40 all over the bottom of that iceberg. It's pulling it in. So it's getting hotter. The Himalayas are melting, creating giant lakes that never existed before. And then those lakes break, and they flood everything downstream of it. Villages, everything gets wiped out. Billions of gallons of water released in minutes. There's no way to protect oneself. Nothing can withstand it. They never had that before. We just had one 2 weeks ago. The Andes are almost all melted. But that ice, when it melted, provided water for over 20 million Andeans and their farms. No more. I have finished driving through Kansas and Oklahoma and Utah and New Mexico and all of the states in the West. Talk with any farmer, and they'll tell you, the water's running out. You'll see barren fields. You'll see weeds where there once was prairies with grasses that fed their cattle. Not anymore. You don't see this on our news. You don't hear the interviews with the farmers. You should, because we're going to be impacted. So what does it mean? It means that it is not if we're going to get a Category 3, 4, or 5 hurricane hitting the major cities on the East Coast. It's just when. It might be this year. Sandy was just a minor little blip compared to what's coming at us. It's inevitable. It's going to happen. So we cannot reverse global warming at this moment. It's tipped. Of the 12 tipping points that are essential, there are actually more, but of the 12 that I focused on in my new documentary, and a major, major book, over 1,400 pages written to date on our environment, 5 of the 12 tipping points cannot be stopped. They will tip. So what I'm suggesting is educate yourself. Look for the places most likely to provide a quality of life and sustainability for you, your family, your career, away from the shorelines, away from nuclear power plants, away from tornado valleys and major earthquake fault lines. If you can do that, then no matter what happens or doesn't happen, you're going to be more likely to have a life in the future. For everyone else who thinks it's just not important, boring news, well, it's going to happen, and I hope that you are prepared. Now, let me just add something else on to this, because this is essential. I'm told by my engineer that all the other phones are now down, so we'll try to reboot them in a moment. Sorry for that. The number is 888-874-4888. Not to worry, I have plenty to share with you. This is from the Mail Online, from the Daily Mail, by Victoria Wollison. Quote, a storm is coming. The sun's poles are set to flip within 4 months, and it could lead to bad weather and radio disruptions. The sun's magnetic field reverses its polarity once every 11 years or so. Flip represents a peak in solar activity where a burst of energy or release. These bursts can lead to space storms and changes in the Earth's climate. Radio and satellite communications may also be affected. The sun's magnetic field is expected to flip in the next 3 to 4 months, and it could lead to major climate storms and disruptions to satellites. This solar event only happens about every 11 years and signals what physicists call the solar maximum, a time when the sun's solar activity is at its highest. During this peak in activity, the outbursts of solar energy can increase the amount of cosmic and ultraviolet rays coming towards the Earth and this can interfere with radio communications, cause solar bursts of light, also known as flares, and can affect the planet's temperature. During the sun's cycle, the amount of solar activity reaches peaks and troughs known as solar maximum and solar minimum. During solar maximum, the amount of solar activity is at its highest due to a flip or reversal of the sun's magnetic field. Since 1976, there have been three solar maximums, and they occur roughly 11 years apart. And during a solar maximum, large numbers of sunspots appear in the sun's irradiance, or electromagnetic radiation output grows. This increase in energy can impact global climate, and recent studies have shown some correlation with regional weather patterns. Quote, it looks like we're no more than 3 to 4 months away from a complete field reversal, solar physicist Dr. Todd Hochschema of Stanford University told NASA Science. This change will have ripple effects throughout the solar system. The sun's magnetic fields are very strong. Now, quote, scientists at Stanford's Wilcox Solar Observatory have been studying the sun's magnetic fields since 1976. In 1859, a solar storm known as the 1859 Solar Superstorm, or Carrington event, after Richard C. Carrington, who recorded the event, saw numerous solar flares appear all over Earth. It was so strong that the Northern Lights, a natural light display that appears predominantly in that Arctic and Antarctic regions, and is caused by the collision of energetic charges in the magnetosphere and solar wind, were said to have been visible as far as Rome. In 1859, and from August 28th to September 2nd, sunspots and solar flares were observed. It was so strong that telegraph service was disrupted. Solar flares created by changes in solar activity also release X-rays and ultraviolet radiation. Now, just 2 weeks ago, a solar storm occurred that was so horrific, it would have exceeded anything that the Earth has experienced in human history. It was in our orbit, but we weren't there. That's how close we came. And here's a question for you. Do you know of any news channel that reported on it, that had we been in that cycle, we would have had no electricity anywhere on the planet for 100 years. That's how bad it was. We missed it. Are we going to keep being that lucky? And what can you do to protect yourself? I've already gone. I've written an article on it, what to do in a crisis, including solar storm. It's up on my website. It's there as a public service. Download it. Read it. This is from Kevin Hayden from the Activist Post. It's a long piece. I'll only give you the parts that are important because it shows you what can happen. And this is all scientifically valid. Some time ago, we discussed the broad implications of electromagnetic pulse attack, such as that from an aerial detonation of a nuclear device, and the similar effects of a large solar storm or coronal mass ejection from the sun. In that discussion, we looked at the overall aspects of the crisis, including interruptions to our trucking industry, which in turn would represent a massive failure in our food, health, and fuel delivery systems. Other topics included traffic gridlock, potential vehicle failure, and briefly, what to expect when the lights go out. Today, we will dive into a more technical look at what even the most minor of electrical hiccups and disturbances can do to our delicate, computerized world, as well as explore how interconnected our society truly is. However, in order to adequately set the stage for understanding the grave threat under conditions in which all of our infrastructures fall prey to simultaneous failure, it is imperative to understand that the vulnerability of the whole of all the highly interlocked critical infrastructures may be greater than the sum of the vulnerability of its parts. If a singular system goes down, it can result in a cascade of failures across the spectrum, from communications to banking to government services, even water treatment plants and sanitation. And while many articles paint a bleak overall picture of a few singular failures, there are some extremely dangerous situations that are often overlooked, especially within the oil, gas, and nuclear sectors. Many of these modern marvels rely on remote systems to operate, acquire data, and perform mundane actions, which are not only grid-dependent, but highly sensitive to electrical disturbances. In particular, the 2008 Congressional EMP Commission thought it too important to single out the growth in common infrastructural infiltration of one particular transformative technology. Quote, the development of automated monitoring and control systems, the ubiquitous robots of the modern age known as supervisory control and data acquisition systems, end quote. Well, what is this supervised control and data acquisition called SCADA system? It's an electronic control system that may be used for data acquisition and control over large and geographically distributed infrastructure systems. And then it goes on to explain all that, which is secondary to this. When any one of these systems malfunctions, they often require a technician to physically go to some remote location and reset it, power it back on, diagnose the issue, or flip a switch. While there are entire career fields devoted to resetting these systems, there's only so many technicians in a given geographical area. As we have witnessed time and again, both the private and public sector have had difficulty in staffing responses to natural disasters that only affect a relatively small region, such as hurricanes. With a robust electromagnetic pulse attack or severe electromagnetic disturbance, there are likely not enough technicians or engineers in the entire world to handle the issue. If the electromagnetic disturbance impacted a large swath of the United States, it could take years before workers are able to respond to even remote terminals, let alone handle the logistics of commanding a small army of technicians having little or no communications, hampered fuel delivery systems in a site that can barely handle 1 week without power, as seen during both Hurricane Sandy and Katrina. The real dangers arise when extrapolating what will happen when oil field pipelines fail to open and close properly, when nuclear power plants can no longer regulate their temperatures, and wastewater treatment plants fail to deliver. Oil and gas refiners, compressors, pipelines, nuclear reactors, and electrical plants will cease to operate due to a multitude of cascading failures, which in turn will shut down most powered communications as well as cause extensive physical damage. One example, August 19, 2000, explosion occurred at one of three adjacent natural gas pipelines near Carlsbad, New Mexico, operated by El Paso Natural Gas Company. The pipeline supplied consumers and electric utilities in Arizona and Southern California. 12 people, including 5 children, died as a result of the explosion. The explosion left an 86-foot-long crater. After the pipeline failure, the Department of Transportation Office Pipeline Safety ordered the pipeline to be shut down. The explosion happened because of failures in maintenance and loss of awareness, conditions that would be replicated by data acquisition disruption everywhere. Now, when even a handful of these critical infrastructures go down, it places other systems that might have not been affected into overload status in an effort to make up for the loss, which can result in further failures. Once electrical generation is down, communication is lost. Those not in the directly impacted areas will still experience the ill effects of these failures due to so many systems being interwoven. Emergency services, hospitals only operate for a few days on backup power and limited fuel. And once the banks close their doors due to their main networks and financial hubs being hampered, the entire economy ceases to exist for all general intents and purposes. ATMs and credits will not work. It'll all be worthless. With banking, communications, and electrical generation crippled, government services will no longer be able to issue financial assistance to those who depend upon it to live, nor will central governments be able to legislate effectively. There will be no ambulances or fire trucks after a few days. The stock market will close. Cellular tower operations will cease after 48 hours on backup batteries. And based upon previous disasters, one can expect a large number of police, government, and military forces to abandon their posts within a few short days. What's our Achilles heel? Fuel. One of the weakest points in our fragile system will be the availability of fuel. Rail, truck, airline, maritime, backup, electrical generators, and more will be affected. According to the America Truckers Association report, service station fuel supplies will start to run out in just 2 days. An average service station requires a delivery every 2 to 4 days. Based on these statistics, the busiest service stations could run out of fuel within a few hours of truck stoppage, with the remaining stations be gone in a day. You'll have significant food shortages in as little as 1 to 3 days, especially for perishable items following a national emergency. Without truck transportation and fuel, health care will be immediately jeopardized. Hospitals have moved to just-in-time inventory systems similar to grocery stores. These systems depend on trucks deliver needed supplies within hours of order placement. Within a short period of time, hospitals will be simply empty of all medicines. Pharmacy stocks and prescription drugs will be gone. In regards to sanitation and waste removal, Americans will be literally buried in garbage with serious health and environmental consequences within days of a fuel shortage. But it gets worse. Within our highly technical world, there are a myriad of chain reactions that most of us cannot even fathom. And at the top of that list is nuclear power plants. In the United States alone, we currently have 100 operating nuclear reactors situated in 61 operating sites. During the March 11, 2011 earthquake that disrupted the Fukushima Daiichi nuclear plant in Japan, it was not the actual quake that led to the catastrophic meltdown. Instead, it was the loss of their backup power generation that was knocked out by the subsequent tsunami waves. Without power, the plant was unable to keep their containment pools effectively cooled, which arguably pose a much greater threat to safety than the actual nuclear reactor core. Containment pools store spent fuel rods, which have already been used in the reactor but are still incredibly hot, both temperature-wise as well as in the radioactive level. These rods typically spend several years in super-chilled pools of water to cool them down to levels that can be contained within concrete storage locations. Unfortunately, the world's nuclear power plants, as they are currently designed, are critically dependent upon maintaining connection to a functioning electrical grid for all but relatively short periods of electrical blackout in order to keep their reactor cores continuously cooled so as to avoid catastrophic reactor core meltdown and spent fuel rod pond fires. If an extreme geomagnetic disturbance were to cause widespread grid collapse, which it most certainly will, in as little as 1 to 2 hours after such a nuclear reactor facility backup generators either fail to start or run out of fuel, the reactor core will start to melt down. After a few days without electricity to the running of the cooling system pumps, the water bath covering the spent fuel rods in the spent fuel ponds will boil away, allowing the stored fuel rods to melt down and burn. And since the Nuclear Regulatory Commission currently mandates that only 1 week's supply of backup generating fuel needs to be stored at each reactor site, it is likely that after we witness the spectacular celestial light show from the next extreme GMD, we will have about 1 week in which to prepare ourselves for an Armageddon. As Mr. Stein points out, the Nuclear Regulatory Commission requires only 1 week worth of fuel to be stored for each nuclear site. Currently, many of the logistical points of that plan depend upon interconnected systems that will all be severely decimated in a large-scale electromagnetic event. And then it goes into how bad it can get for people who are even unaware of this. I shared this with you simply to let you know that 3 years ago, to suggest that we would have a major nation and a major nuclear facility that would have the destruction of its nuclear power plant, spilling hundreds of millions of gallons of radioactive water into the ocean, into the soil, into its aquifers, that would be going off 24/7 into the air, spreading all over the country, you'd have thought not possible. Well, now we have that in Fukushima. Just this week, we were told that the Prime Minister of Japan has interceded because of the lies, the cover-up, and the fact that they need to engage the government now to solve the problem. It is getting worse, not better. It is still entirely possible that there will be another earthquake that could cause the remaining spent fuel rods, which are suspended, to fall. If that happens, you will have an event about 70 times worse than Chernobyl. We will all be impacted, but the people in China and Japan and Korea will be really put into a precarious situation. So just when we're told, don't worry, be happy, I'm saying, wake up, take a look at your environment, take a look at the disasters happening today as we speak. I looked at the worldwide environmental impact today. I studied each day from around the world. You have dozens of earthquakes. You have a volcano going off in the South Pacific. You have flooding in islands. You have flooding in Europe. You have massive flooding in England. You have fires in California, drought in the United States, and flooding in North Carolina and in Georgia. And yet, I see none of this represented as a political or social issue, and that is a problem. Sorry that we couldn't get our phones working today. We'll have them working certainly for tomorrow's program. Thank you very much for listening. I'm Gary Nall.